Well, good afternoon, everyone. This is a Eternal Flame News Special Edition. It is 4 p.m. Eastern here in the JMC Studios. We have with us today my co-host, Joshua Turner, a second-year law student and president of the Federalist Society chapter at his school. As a former assistant youth pastor and Christian libertarian, he brings a unique perspective to facing issues facing the nation today. Josh is a current editor for the summer 2012 issue of the Harvard Journal on Law and Public Policy. He will assist in editing conservative authors' articles relating to the administrative state. Josh most recently served as a special deputy county attorney for the Maricopa County, where he prosecuted minor felonies and misdemeanor cases ranging from drug possession to assault and then to DUIs. He regularly blogs on the intersection of religion and politics and has appeared on shows including Fox News, Fox Nation, and His Politics. He's an avid Vikings fan and has suffered through many close seasons. He can be contacted at joshuaturner85@gmail.com. Thank you, Josh, for coming. I know that we've met on the Kevin McCullough Show, and I've been following all the things you've been doing in Arizona. How's it going over there in the wonderful sunny state, as I like to call it?
Jeremy, thanks for having me on. Yeah, it's hot today. It's about 104 and getting warmer. Summer is here. You know, we get to brace for temperatures of 115 and higher.
Oh, outstanding. I just got to love wonderful, wonderful hot days like that. You know, it makes me miss Texas, but then when I hear 104, you know, but isn't it like a dry heat because it's not really that much humidity, or is it really humid there?
It depends. It's primarily a dry heat. You get some humidity during monsoon season. We're about a month or so away from monsoon season out here.
Yeah.
The big worry right now is all the wildfires that are going on across the state. Doing some pretty good damage. You know, unfortunately, out here, it's a yearly occurrence with these wildfires.
Wow. Well, man, I know today has been a big, big turning of events with so much going on. Everyone's talking about Facebook IPO and what the pricing and that's going to be. But I've been looking at what is going to happen this weekend going into NATO. I see that the fighter jets are already flying over Chicago, and so much is going on. I mean, it's from the Air Force, KC-139 tankers, F-16s, and even the Coast Guard, the 65 Dolphin, all over downtown doing the strategic planning. I know businesses have already been putting plywood up on their windows, and there's barbed wire fences and things going on in the set route. What are your thoughts going into this whole NATO weekend, especially knowing that Turkey has banned Israel from even going?
You know, Jeremy, first let me comment on Facebook. You know, it is truly amazing, and I think it's one of the very few countries where someone can drop, you know, while he's at Harvard, create what was essentially a network to keep in contact with classmates and turn it into what's been valued $104 billion company. It's true American ingenuity and the kind of stuff that we need to see. Now, the downside of that is because of our archaic tax laws that are really penalizing the investors and the inventors in this country. Mm-hmm. We're seeing people like a number of the Facebook co-founders that are renouncing their citizenship to avoid paying the archaic taxes that we have. This is going to really hurt our economy even more as a direct result of the Obama policies and the Democratic policies of taxation. Now, I think this also plays well into NATO and what you're going to see happening, specifically to what is essentially a military buildup of Chicago. I mean, it's unfortunate but necessary given the current state of the economy and things in the world. I mean, if you carry this over to Greece, who very likely will pull out of the euro and go back to using their currency, the drachma, you're going to see European markets completely tank. You're also going to see it affect American markets. To what degree is speculative, but it will definitely affect them. You have France, who under Sarkozy tried to institute austerity measures to bring back their economy, and the French people, who have lived so long dependent on the government, absolutely rejected these austerity measures in this last election and when they elected a socialist, Holland. And I think you're going to see that playing out here as well. As we continue to add to the deficit, more and more people become dependent on the government. We have to make a choice. Are we going to cut spending? spending? Are we going to raise taxes? What are we going to do to address our deficit? Because there will come a time when we're forced to do it. And when we're forced to do it, it's going to come down to basically ripping apart all of the social programs. And you're going to see a massive revolt from that because of everybody that is now dependent on the government. You've had unemployment that is routinely extended time after time after time. And these social programs do not work. They only keep people dependent on government. And I think that's going to be the background for NATO, is the economy. You know, I think when you look at situations like Iraq, Iran, Afghanistan, while that will be a background, kind of playing in the background, and obviously important given Iran's propensity to ignore the world and continue to create nuclear weapons, I think the foremost thing is going to be the economy, and you are going to see the Occupy Wall Street protesters out there in force. You are going to see the liberal anarchists out there. So you're going to get a mix of everyone, and you know, I hate to say it, but I think it will at times turn violent.
You're completely right. One of the things I want to back up on is I saw a video, and it's you're only hearing Will Smith's side of the conversation in English, but he gets interviewed overseas, and one of the questions they tell him is like, how do you feel about the fact that America's free? And he's like, yeah, that's great. And then the next thing is you see the shock and awe on Will Smith's face when they say they want to have 75% tax. 75% taxes on all citizens. Now, I know just recently they're talking about, well, the government's, you know, just took a 30% pay cut, and we're going to turn around and tax the people 75%. And you got to realize the other point, this is a socialist elected president. And Josh is completely right when it comes to this situation with why are they taking so many security measures with NATO. We already know that the anonymous website and the Occupy group have said this is their Red Dawn moment, their defining moment on how they can try and overthrow the government. That's exactly what they want to do. They want to do a chaos theory where they want to come in with whatever signs, whatever supposed peaceful things, and what we've seen in Oakland and what we've seen in New York, that's what they want to do with NATO. They want to come in and walk right into the building, just like they already did with President Obama's headquarters. Occupy already walked in there and tried to take over, essentially wanting to, you know, overthrow the government. I guess they think the movie V for Vendetta is something that we're supposed to do, you know, and their purpose is to bring upon more of this socialist movement. I've had an investigation going on here locally and across the globe on the Occupy movement and on the Socialist Party as a whole, and what I found out is the close ties to several different organizations, particularly that Organizing for America that's supposed to be working for Obama. We already realized that the fact that Jeremiah Wright has come out and has pretty much kicked Obama under the bus, there's rumor of a two other party group or another Democrat that's trying to come in. You know, we have Biden end up speaking very openly and candidly that he understands why West Virginia would rather vote for a Democrat person who is in jail versus Obama. So I'm seeing some things being set up for this completely dynamic shift. I know there's rumors that Hillary Clinton might be involved. We have a couple of other party members that are involved. And it's just getting to a point where if we don't protect the sanity and the sanctity of what we are as a nation, as a people, we're going to lose a lot of rights. And we are going to become more of a fascist country. I know people are arguing with me and saying, well, Jeremy, I don't think we're going to be a socialist country. We're not going to elect a socialist president. And I said, well, what about this evolving movement that keeps going on and on and on how we are? I mean, for instance, how Obama's endorsing gay marriage, and then we find out more with what Wright's talking about, that all these black pastors were pretty much bought off or being told, you know, they're going to do these things. So then we have Romney coming out, speaking at Liberty University, telling evangelicals that their values are his too. What do you think about this, Josh?
You know, I think, I mean, the first thing we have to be careful is, you know, everything with, as conservatives, we cannot make Reverend Wright and this whole mess that has been going on a key focal point in the election.
Exactly.
I think part of the reason for that is McCain failed in 2008 to use this. You know, there was obviously material about President Obama's association with not only Reverend Wright, but also with Bill Ayers in 2008.
Mm-hmm.
And for whatever reason, the McCain campaign decided not to use this information. It's almost kind of, you know, like going back to it after the fact, you know, and I think we have to be careful with that. I think what we have to do is keep the American people focused on the economy. And that's what's going to help the conservative cause. That's what's going to help Mitt Romney win. All these other issues, I think, in some ways, truly are distractions. And I don't mean to downplay the issue of gay marriage and whether it's a civil right or not a civil right and the Christian community's opinion on it. But we do need to be very careful because I don't think, at a federal standpoint, in a federal election, these issues help us.
Exactly.
We'll give credit to President Obama because what he did say correctly in his statement about gay marriage was that it was a state issue. It was not a federal issue.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Jeremy, you know me. I am a federalist at a core. I believe in an original interpretation of the Constitution, that the federal government should be kept as small as possible, doing only the things outlined in the Constitution. All other, you know, laws, rules, rights, provisions are left to the state.
Mm-hmm.
So Obama was correct in saying that while he does support gay marriage, it is a state issue. And for that, I will give him credit. Now, when we look at the gay marriage issue itself from a Christian standpoint, but I also want to look at it from a libertarian standpoint,
mm-hmm.
because there is no doubt in my mind that the Bible is absolutely correct in that homosexuality is a sin. But I think a lot of times what rubs people off and rubs people the wrong way when Christians are out there saying this is we do not, as Christians, do an effective job of saying it is a sin, yes, but it's a sin just like any other sin.
Exactly.
And we throw the baby out with the bathwater a lot of times.
Mm-hmm.
We have to get to the notion that as Christians we are supposed to hate the sin but love the sinner. You know, and we work with them and give them the option. We can't force our views on anyone. If you look at what Jesus Christ came and did during his time before the crucifixion, he did not force his views upon anyone.
No.
In fact, he told his followers that there will be times that people reject you, that they curse you, that they throw stones at you, and you are to, you know, walk out of the town and dust the dirt off from your sandals.
Mm-hmm.
And I think a lot of times we forget that in this, it has to be our way or the highway. I mean, Thomas Jefferson really, you know, he was a deist. You know, he believed that there was a God, you know, and he spoke highly, he spoke in terms of Jesus Christ. He would not self-identify as a Christian. But what he did say was, if it does not affect me or my pocketbook, let it be. So we really have to ask ourselves at this point in our country, how is gay marriage affecting our individual lives and our pocketbook? Because we can say yes, we don't agree with it, we don't support it. However, is it affecting me or is it affecting my pocketbook? And that's where the libertarian view comes in. And as a libertarian Christian, I'm often torn on this because, as I said, you know, I do believe in the word of the Bible that it is God's word and that homosexuality is a sin. But when you realistically look at whether or not homosexuality is affecting me, you know, it's not. Is it affecting my pocketbook? It's not. If you look at tax implications, there can be an argument made either way for those that support same-sex marriage and those that do not support it. I think what you have to look at, though, is what is the most important point in our country right now, and that's the economy. Right now, you know, it was said in the early 90s by James Carville, it's the economy, stupid, and the same thing can be said today. It's still the economy, and I'm not stupid. You know, we have to get away from these distractions, and I don't want to say social issues are a distraction, but we have to look at what does the country need most right now. And that is a strong fiscal leader that will promote conservative fiscal principles. And I don't always agree with Mitt Romney. In fact, I was not a Mitt Romney supporter. He was not my first choice for president. Newt Gingrich was. I've, you know, spoken heavily on this topic and why I thought Newt Gingrich was the best choice. But the people have spoken. The people have said that Mitt Romney will be the standard bearer for the Republican Party. Mitt Romney does have the conservative credentials to, in my opinion, rebuild this economy. He is not the perfect social conservative. He's obviously changed his opinions a number of times, and there's still some stuff that I don't agree with him on. But when it comes to fiscal conservative issues, he is the only one running that has the experience necessary to jumpstart this economy. And that is why I think evangelical Christians, who largely in 2008 voted for Obama because of this hope and change idea and almost got hoodwinked, and I think it in some ways can be traced back to when Obama appeared with Rip Warren at Settleback Community Church for a debate with John McCain. You know, and in that debate, he did say that he believed gay marriage, or that marriage was between a man and a woman. Now, this countered his earlier position when he had said, when he was still in local Illinois politics, that he believed that same-sex couples had a right to marry and he would fight for that right. So Obama has also changed his opinion a number of times. But the bottom line is, we have to get away from these issues. Yes, they can be background issues. Yes, they are important. But they do not come to the level of importance that the economy does. I mean, we can tackle and reach solutions on all the social issues, but that doesn't do anything if our country is still in flames from the economy. You know, if you have a house in a shed burning, what are you going to save? You're going to try to save your house first and then go to the shed. Now, I look at the shed as a social issue. Obviously, they're a concern. We need to look at how we can best address them as Americans, but the main thing is the house with everything in it, and that's the economy. In terms of social issues, I think that we need to leave them up to the states. I mean, North Carolina just passed a resolution saying that they do not want same-sex marriage. Other countries, such as Vermont and New York, have said they do want same-sex marriage. What you see is a reflection of different cultures. That's what makes America great. It's what our founders provided for in the Constitution. Yes, you do get kind of a hodgepodge of laws here and there, but it does reflect the cultural norms closer to the people that are directly affected by the laws, and that's what our founding fathers wanted to happen. They didn't want this massive bureaucracy that would, you know, dictate laws like a king on high from D.C. to a vast and diverse country. They wanted a federal government that would provide for the common defense and a few other strictly written things in the Constitution and leave everything else to the people at their local state level.
You're exactly right. And like I was saying with this whole situation, with the possibility of a terrorist assassination on anyone who goes to a NATO event, that's a public thing that anyone can realize. Any kind of big event like this, there's always extra security. But at the other side of the coin, it's like what Josh is talking about here, is what happens the closer we get to elections. If you haven't paid any attention, what does always happen every year? There's always this discord and division amongst the Republican Party. And what happens is they keep trying to find ways, you know, the far left, the far right, which keep trying to find ways to go against each other, find more dirt. And as it gets closer to November, like I said, more people are going to start coming forward that are probably partly in being involved with the Democrats, which I realized there was the rumor about which Democrats switch sides to vote for either Santorum or vote for Romney and all this stuff. But now that we're actually down to the actual candidate who has already been, you know, nominated for the Republican Party, we have to stop fighting amongst ourselves. And that's one of the biggest issues that I've seen, is this big division amongst ourselves. And a good example is coming up on the 8th of June, there's going to be another rally for religious freedom, and it goes right hand in hand about the Supreme Court's ruling on Obamacare. Now, this is another piece that we're split on, and it honestly really does put Republicans in a tough spot. Like, what should we do as a political party as whole? Should we, you know, go completely against it and want it completely abolished out and don't want anything to do with it? Do we try and let it stick around, do some amendments? But like what Josh said, is the reason why going around talking to people that I have, voting for Romney, the reason why you have to do that is these other party members, these other entities that are going to start popping up in the next 2 or 3 months aren't going to win unless something, you know, really radical happens. I mean, we can look back at Reagan, how he kept not getting nominated in the beginning, and then he finally did. But that's the point. If you don't get to a certain level at this, you have to look at the bigger picture. I understand there's things about Romney I don't agree with, Josh said it too, but look at the bigger picture of what's going on. The argument's been, you know, what's the two of the lesser evils? Same thing goes with this, you know, healthcare issue. I realize there are a bunch of colleges right now and other programs that are actually removing the healthcare insurance for the students who live on dorm because they said the new ruling and the new paperwork the college is getting, it's too expensive. And I realize that we're going to have to come to a point and make some really tough decisions in the next few months. What do you think, Josh?
I think what you have to look at with the whole overarching theme of Obamacare is we do need insurance reform. I'll start there.
Yes.
You know, we do need to reform the insurance industry. But I think we've gone about it the wrong way.
Mm-hmm.
I think what we need to do is enable people to buy insurance across state lines, similar to buying auto insurance.
Exactly.
Right now, healthcare, you can't buy a healthcare plan from New Jersey for you
mm-hmm.
here in Arizona, or anywhere for that matter, because we don't allow health insurance to be purchased across state lines.
Exactly.
You can purchase auto insurance across state lines, but not health insurance.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what you would see immediately upon allowing health insurance to be purchased across state lines is competition.
Yes.
And I know competition has now become a dirty word, and I think we'll talk more about that later and some other issues, but we need to get away from this idea that competition is bad. Competition is not bad. Competition is going to drive up the product, the quality of the product, and it's mm-hmm. going to drive down the price. You're going to get the best product at the cheapest possible price. The other thing we need to do, and I know my fellow future lawyers are probably going to hang me for saying this, but we need tort reform. We need to make sure that we are holding the doctors accountable, but that we're not handing out huge, you know, tens of million dollar verdicts for pain and suffering. It needs to be, you know, equitable. Courts of America are courts of equity. They're attempting to reestablish the wronged party to the position that they were before the wrong occurred. You know, so I don't see how someone can justify saying a $20 million punitive award is placing that person in the same position they were before the act, the wrong. In specific terms of Obamacare, what we have to look at is the provisions of Obamacare. Obviously, the biggest, which the Supreme Court addressed, and they'll probably rule on here in about a month and a half or so, is the mandate. Now, when you look at the mandate, what is it? The mandate is saying that by, I believe, 2014, every person in the United States will have to have insurance, whether it is some form of government insurance, like Medicare, Medicaid,
mm-hmm.
employer insurance, or buying it on your own. If you do not have insurance, there is a penalty. There's debate whether it's a penalty or a tax. I think that's part of Nancy Pelosi's famous line that we have to pass the bill to know what's in it. Well, the bill was passed, and we're still trying to figure out what's in it, not only in terms of tax and the penalty, but also in terms of contraception. So obviously, within the last 3 months or so, it's been a big, almost brouhaha over this contraception issue and whether the government can force religious employers, such as the Catholic Church, obviously being the big one, to provide contraception for their employees, even though it is against their religious beliefs. Yeah, I have a few things I could comment on, specifically the issue of contraception,
mm-hmm.
and telling, you know, my opinion that I think it's almost time to join the 21st century and look realistically, but at the same time, it is their right to believe that contraception goes against the Bible.
Yeah.
You know, I don't want to get into a debate over what the Bible says in issues of contraception and beliefs of the Catholic Church or any other church, but I think what we have to look at is we are a country established on the freedom of religion,
mm-hmm.
and though we always have varying degrees of religion and fights within religion, the beliefs are what hold paramount. So I think it is plainly unconstitutional, and there have been Supreme Court rulings that would back me up, that the United States government cannot force a religious institution to provide contraception coverage for their employees when it blatantly goes against their religious beliefs.
Exactly.
Now, there are some questions as to what about a hospital, you know, that's going to employ Catholics and non-Catholics. How do you get around that?
Mm-hmm.
Well, and what if it's a quasi-Catholic organization that still receives state funding? Obviously, those issues are always going to be around, but the bottom line here is, if it, you know, in terms of contraception, if it is a religious employer, I would first say that the religious employee really needs to look at what they're gaining or losing, you know, in this fight, and look at how closely those beliefs are and how important they are. And remember that they want to be a part of society because, yes, the government does not have a right to force them to do this, but in a sense, society can. And I mean society can by saying that backlash, you know, boycott, negative public opinion. You know, we saw that hit Susan B. Komen Foundation Susan G. Komen, not too long ago when they originally said they were going to cut off funding for Planned Parenthood. They initially gained a lot of money, but then they lost a lot of money. That said, okay, we will now continue to give grants to Planned Parenthood in the area of cervical cancer research and services. The public perception obviously matters, especially in the age of technology and social networking. So the institution itself has to look at those values and say, how can we keep our faith and our values, but also accommodate a growing and changing society? I'm not asking the church to change their values. I am asking them, how can we approach explaining our values and possibly giving a little here that doesn't affect our values and beliefs? And I think that's not necessarily a government infringement, but adjusting to society and the needs of society. Now, the other provisions of the mandate, I think, are just as blatantly unconstitutional. And to tell someone that you have to buy a product has never been done in this country before. Now, one of the theories that the Obama administration is arguing the validity and constitutionality of Obamacare is under the Commerce Clause. But I think they're sorely mistaken because the Commerce Clause can regulate commerce. You know, it can regulate commerce between the states. And while the Commerce Clause has been widened drastically over the last few decades, mm-hmm. never before has the Commerce Clause been used to create commerce, because essentially that's what this bill is doing. It is creating commerce to say you must buy insurance, and then we're going to regulate it. So on the one hand, it's creating something that's not there by forcing people to buy it, and then it's regulating. And I use the word forcing people because of the tax penalty, which if you don't pay, then you can go to jail, which is in the provision. So we have to look at the constitutionality of it. And ultimately, you know, yes, the argument that, oh, well, people need insurance, you know, why can't we be a humane society? So I look at that and I say, yes, you know, we do have to care for those that are in need.
Yes, you're
but
right. You're right.
It's supposed to be done at the local level and it's not supposed to be done by force. You know, the scariest phrase in America, in my opinion, and it's been said before, is I'm from the government and I'm here to help.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if we're going to say we can't trust the government in this area, why are we then going to say, oh, but we can trust them with our health care? It makes absolutely no sense to me. So I think the Supreme Court's going to come down and rule that Obamacare is unconstitutional,
mm-hmm.
and that'll be a huge win for Republicans. But if for some reason the Supreme Court comes and says that it is valid and constitutional, it's going to hinder Republicans, because at that point, President Obama can come and say, hey, this has been my biggest piece of legislation to help you guys. The Republicans fought it tooth and nail. They fought it all the way up to the Supreme Court, spending thousands upon thousands of taxpayer dollars to fight this, and they lost. You know, they've been dragging their feet. They don't support the middle and American class who this bill is there to help, and that's what you'll hear if he wins. So it's going to be, I think, you know, the Affordable Care Act will be one of the deciding points of the election. I don't think it'll be as big as the economy, but I would rate it right there as second or third most important issue following the economy.
Exactly. And I realize that, you know, if it passes, if it doesn't pass, we always have to keep ourselves on guard on this, because let's say it does pass. What's the next step for Republicans? What's the next step for us as individuals? We still would have to go that next step to try and relook at some of this and try and change it and fix it. Because I have not talked to anyone that's involved in healthcare that seems happy about this. Now, I've talked to just regular people just on the street that aren't involved in politics, that aren't involved in the medical care as a career. And they say, oh, I think it'd be good to get health care for everybody. And then I remind them, we have Medicare and Medicaid already, and Social Security, and these are programs that need repair. And then they stop talking because they realize it already exists. And I know there's an argument, well, we need to have health care for more people and everything. And yes, the whole religious freedom, like I said, June 8th is the Rally for Religious Freedom again, talking specifically about this mandate. That's the day I'm actually graduating, so I won't be able to participate this year. But their website just got hacked, just like last week, because it turned out somebody did not want this message to come out, that he did not want these Catholics and everyone, all the religious right to come out and say, hey, I'm not for this. There's other opportunities and things we can do to fix it. I believe the church should be able to help people, and I've talked about this in my own speeches. It's that I believe the church is able to help people without having the government assistance. You know, there comes a time when government assistance is needed, but there's this balance, big issue going on, and I keep seeing that. You know, it doesn't matter if you go to college or not, and you don't see an extreme liberal view like a college platform does. It's right down the street from you. You just talk to people, learn how they're talking and the different directions of where they're going, because you'll find out real quickly that there are so many different ways that we can fix this. Yeah, tort reform, there's a few other things that we need to stop doing. We need to stop making these bills created by an entity outside of the House and Congress who gets paid, and they make these thousands of pages of stuff that one or two, three people might have known about. And then by the time it gets, you know, passed, nobody knows what's going on anymore. That's one of the biggest issues I have right now with, it doesn't matter if it's right or left, we are passing bills that we don't even know what they say. You know, it reminds me of the movie Amazing Grace. There's a scene in it where they get this bill so massive and they keep reading and reading, and everyone in Parliament just starts leaving because they're bored. I'm assuming that's what's happening here. They get so many pages, nobody wants to read 1,000 pages. We got Kagan saying, well, I haven't read 1,000 pages, and so on and so forth. It just keeps going and building and building and building to this threshold point where it just breaks down. And that's the point. This is that chaos theory again, where if you want to cause chaos and discord and you want to make these short corners and niches of bills and extra things added on, you make a bill so big that no one's going to take the time to look at it. And like you said, we've already taken this to the Supreme Court, and they've already made a ruling, but we're still reading the bill. Why do we keep doing this to ourselves? When are we going to learn to own up to and accept responsibility that, yes, we need to have smaller government. Yes, we need to not have monopolies of hospitals. I don't know how many towns I've been in where there's only one main hospital facility. They have all of the doctors, they have all of the labs, and they have all of the surgeons, and no one else is there. And what happens? Not only do they make all the money, they can increase the amount of bills. They can increase the amount of whatever. There's no productivity. There's no, you know, capitalist anything going on in this infrastructure. What are we doing to ourselves? You know, it used to be bad to want to have all this monopoly stuff. Like, a good example is the phone company. How they kept raising the rates back in the day when Ameritech was around and AT&T, and they split. And what happened? We had more affordable phone services. Why? Because other people were able to use their talents and abilities and could start their own small businesses, which became enterprises and larger corporations, and have grown to become what we now know as Sprint and T-Mobile and Verizon. But that wouldn't have happened if we kept going in this one set rule where we're just going to have one person and that's how it's going to go. You know, it gets me to the point where I really worry about the future of America. If we don't have more people like Josh and myself step up to the plate and not be afraid to talk about these issues. That's one of the biggest things I've seen, is silence.
Well, we don't want to criticize big business. I mean,
no.
You know, there are certain, you know, if they're acting illegally and doing
exactly
the wrong things according to the law,
mm-hmm,
yes, they need to be held accountable.
Exactly.
But when we look at businesses like Verizon, like T-Mobile, like Sprint,
mm-hmm,
you know, they are, again, American success stories.
Exactly.
You know, and we need to hold them in high regard, because the jobs they create, the revenue that they do create, you know, and I think when we look at businesses in some ways have gotten a bad rap.
Mm-hmm.
Part of that is their own fault. Part of that is also the government's fault. And I think Mitt Romney is right in that we should have let GM go bankrupt. The reason we should have let GM go bankrupt is because they could have gone into a structured reorganization and came out stronger.
Exactly.
Instead of now, we own stock in GM as American taxpayers, yes, but we're never going to see that full value return to us.
No.
And if you look, Ford was in the same exact position as GM at the time. Ford decided we are going to be a true American company and refused to take government handout. Now look at Ford's sales and where they're at in terms of their economy in the car market. They are doing amazing work and they're continuing to grow. They've completely rebounded. They have the sources on hand. Let's look at another great American company that right now has more money on hand in cash reserves from the American government, Apple. So we have to get back to this notion of hard work and really the American dream. We've moved away from what was once an industrial country to a service-oriented country. Mm-hmm. The Frappuccino, Starbucks, McDonald's country.
Exactly.
And we have to get away from that. We have to encourage ingenuity. We have to encourage invention. And we have to encourage investors. And how do we do that? We do that by bringing down our tax code, rewarding competition, and increasing the chances for American success.
You're exactly right, because I remember where, depending on what college you went to, you got special scholarships, four different degrees, because they were looking for the not just the cream of the crop, but people that had the creativity to want to bring something that was never tried before. That was the thing about the 40s, 50s, 60s, is that people were being awarded a chance on faith. That was part of the big thing about American Dream. Now, if you go into a communication studies degree, they'll use like the Horatio myth and everything, saying the American Dream is non-existent. It cannot happen. Nobody can attain this. Well, you're listening to a man that was once homeless, who's about to graduate from college, who has his own full-time ministry. If I can do that and come from nothing and become something else, and I have even further plans with my bachelor's degree and everything else, if I can do that, why can't you? And that's the thing. When we keep hearing these negative connotations of, well, the American dream's dead, and this is how it's going to be, and we're going to just work with the smaller businesses and just do service, and we keep allowing just foreigners to come in, and they're taking a lot of the good jobs. And you want to know why? Because our own people are not waking up to the realization of what someone from another country sees America. Like when I would go,
The problem we're getting into is it's almost a warped view of the American dream, which is leading people to say the American dream is not possible.
Exactly.
And this warped view of the American dream is that the American dream is success, which mm-hmm. is an absolute lie. The American dream is not success. What the American dream is a chance at success.
Exactly.
No one in my family, back to when my family immigrated here from Norway. I'm primarily Norwegian and Eastern and Western European.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of a hodgepodge of Western European cultures. But my direct ancestors came here from Norway in the late 1800s. They moved to Wisconsin, where they basically, created a number of the towns there.
Mm-hmm.
Now, and they've been factory workers and farmers. Everyone except for my mother has lived and died in the state of Wisconsin or Minnesota. My mom decided to move down with our family to Arizona. None of my family has ever gone to college. I'm the first one to graduate with a bachelor's degree, and that's out of my brothers and sisters. My sister's in college right now. Out of five brothers and sisters, out of 26 cousins, out of 10 aunts and uncles, my grandparents, my great-grandparents, and all down the line. No one in my family, going back to my great-great-grandparents and their descendants,
mm-hmm.
have ever completed a college degree. But I also took that risk. I don't come from a wealthy family where I could just go and, goof around in college.
Mm-hmm.
I've had to take out a number of student loans. I've had to work my way through college.
Exactly.
And when I graduate law school, I will have about $130,000 in debt. And that's the risk I took. Because when you have this opportunity at success, with an opportunity comes a risk. There is no success. There is no reward without risk. And now we hear this mantra from this new generation that says everyone's entitled to a college education.
Mm-hmm.
Or we need student loan relief. Education education is a risk. You are not entitled. Education at the college level is not a right. Let's get that straight first. This myth that a college education is a right is absurd. You know, no one handed me anything. No one handed a lot of people in this country anything.
Mm-hmm.
And to perpetuate this myth, this lie that education is a right, is absurd. It is not a right. It is an opportunity. And with an opportunity, as I said, comes risk. So I will have to work my butt off to pay off those student loans and look at different options that are provided to me. But the government's not responsible for my student loans. My parents aren't responsible for my student loans. I made a conscious choice to take the risk and take out student loans so that I could better myself and have my shot at the American dream, my shot at success, the opportunity to have success.
You know, for the American people listening to this right now that have never attended college, for those of you that are in college, you need to remember when you filled out your FAFSA, you know that form that you filled out and you had to put your tax information? Well, you had to go to another site that was probably studentloans.gov. You had to take a test, and you had to click a few check boxes, get a PIN number, sign some stuff either on paper or digital, and it was essentially, if you read the fine print in the rules where you had to keep scrolling down, well, if you read the rules and regulations, it said it was a binding contract between you and the government that you accept the responsibility of whatever percentage that was going to be placed, you know, the interest on these loans, and that you would pay them back in a timely manner. So for someone to just wipe off the debt of loans would mean that your contract was null and void, and if you're going to null and void contract, then how can there ever be any more contracts made in the first place? I think one of the bigger issues is the whole bailout of the loan company anyway, where the government got involved in that too. That's why we're at this point, because it was all being set up to where they're going to buy it out, and then all these people on the other side, the whole top-down, bottom-out. The government bails out the loan company, so then the other side of the radicals are end up saying, well, we shouldn't have to pay that back. So what happens? Completely implosion of the government and completely changing of the responsibility of people. Yes, it's very true. I do know people that have been homeless and have student loans of like $500 a month. Why were they homeless? Well, some of them were drug addicts. Some of them had criminal records. That's one of the questions they ask you. Do you have any criminal records? So on and so forth. You can't get these loans, blah, blah, blah. And the list goes on and on. Yes, it's a 10 to 20, 30, 40 year payment risk. And I believe at this point, there's a few colleges that have programs that honestly people are signing up for, and the colleges aren't telling you there's no jobs for that.
Well, and that brings up a bigger point, a bigger problem with our economy,
mm-hmm.
is we have equipped people under this mantra, and it goes back to this education is a right. We need an educated society. We need an educated society, absolutely. But we also need a workforce. We are producing too many college-educated people. And I'm not saying we're producing too many college-educated people in general, but in the wrong fields. A woman's studies degree is worthless. You know, a cultural study degree is worthless. Unless you plan on becoming a professor and that's all you plan on doing. What we need to do is have a system in place in high school to identify those that will excel in college and identify those that would be better off going to a trade school. Instead of this notion that, you know, it goes back to when we were kids, we were always told, you can do whatever you want to do.
Exactly.
Well, I'm 5'10", 250 pounds. I can't be a basketball player. You know, even if I got in the best shape of my life, I don't have the skills to be a basketball player, nor do I have the skills to be a baseball pitcher. You know, at one point in high school, I played basketball, but you know, I was okay, not great. You know, I don't have the skills to be a CEO of a Fortune 500 company. I mean, there are certain things that we are not cut out to do, no matter how hard we want to do that. So, yes, we want to encourage people to try and compete, but we got to get rid of this idea of you can be anything you want to be. You can do anything you want to do. Because it's not true. And I don't say that to discourage people, because if you do work hard at what you're good at and you have a realistic goal, that goal can be accomplished.
Mm-hmm.
But if you have a dream of becoming the world's best football player and you're not athletically inclined, sad news is, you're probably not going to be the world's best football player. But you might be a genius when it comes to electrical engineering. So why not focus on electrical engineering? You know, why are we just telling people to go to college without any real direction? I mean, most people in college right now are not even taking their majors until their second or third year. They're just taking whatever classes sound good to them and getting a general degree.
Exactly.
We have to really change that because we're lacking in education, we're lacking in terms of the kinds of degrees we need, and we're falling further and further down the list of the most educated societies while we are pumping more and more money into our failing system. Now, in terms of K-12 schools, the Department of Education was established by Carter in the late 70s. Now, every year since we have passed the law that created the Department of Education at the national level, testing scores have gone down and down and down. Why? Because, again, it goes back to we do not need a federal model for education because different states, different communities are going to need different things. Because we are a hodgepodge nation of different cultures and different beliefs. So we need to be able to respect that and say, yes, we want all of our people to be educated, and we want you to have some standards, but we're going to leave the standards to you because you know what's important in your community and your state.
You're exactly right. And like for instance, I know that they have the Compass test, which is what they have here, which is supposed to check out how your English and math skills are. Here's a solution. Why don't we create something similar to a Compass ACT, you know, SAT test that is a, what's the word I'm looking for here? Not an enrichment, but an assessment exam. Kind of like the ASVAB in the military, where you take these different battery of exams to see what you excel at. Now, I know a lot of vocational schools do this, and high school does this, but what if we had across the board in the United States, you're going to take an assessment exam, and it's going to ask you, you know, various things from like your favorite color, to your favorite foods, to your favorite hobbies, to, you know, assessing your scores from high school, your transcript, and all sorts of different variables, and then it comes out with a list of things that this is what it looks like you'd be good at. Now, depending on where you live, you already have this option, but I think that would totally redefine education, because Josh is completely right on this, is that we're in this position where people just take whatever they want. You know, they get a general education degree. Some of them will get an English degree. Some of them will get a theater degree, music degree, and all these different things, biology degree. And you'll ask them, are you going to be a high school teacher? Are you going to be a professor? And they'll tell you no. And over 50%, I hate saying this, over 50% college graduates with an associate or bachelor degree are not working in the field of what they graduated in. So why don't we change that? Well, there's also
what we have to do, Jeremy, and it goes again, you know, I mentioned competition a little bit ago, and I want to jump to, and it's a local story, but it's happening in different states across the board.
Mm-hmm.
And it's this fear of rewarding the top because others may feel left out. In Arizona, a number of school districts have decided that they're no longer going to have valedictorians. Now, I am a little biased as I was in the top of my class. But to say that we are no longer going to award the number one and number two student, instead we're going to get rid of that and award and honor a number of students generally. The problem with this is it teaches kids to be mediocre. It says,
mm-hmm.
I have to do because I'm going to get an award for being in the top 5%. I don't need to work hard for that extra A.
Exactly.
So why are we driving to do away with competition? In life, everybody's not going to get a trophy. Everybody's not going to win the award.
Exactly.
Everybody, you know, are we going to go to the Super Bowl and say, okay, we're not going to do a point system anymore. We're going to award every team a trophy at the end of the year.
We'll give everybody a Super Bowl ring. How about that? You made it to the Super Bowl. Here's your ring.
You know, it's absurd. We need to honor those that excel. We need to teach them that competition is good if it's done in a way that is fair to everyone. And I don't mean the outcome being fair, but the opportunity to succeed. And I think that's, you know, when you look at Democrats and Republicans, that's the key difference. Republicans and conservatives believe that it's not the outcome that should be fair, but the opportunity. Where Democrats believe that we have to level the playing field so everybody achieves the same outcome, which is not what we are promised. No one promised me that in my life that I'm going to have, you know, the same $500 million or $104 billion that Facebook has.
Yeah.
No one promised me that I'm going to have, you know, a beautiful wife, like Angelina Jolie or someone like that, you know, a movie star famous all across the world, no one promised me that I'm going to have the world's most perfect children. No one promised me anything like that. What I was promised was an opportunity to succeed. And with that opportunity comes risk. It also comes competition. And pushing myself to be the best that I can be with the gifts that I have been given and the steps that I take to better myself. So this notion that we need to get rid of valedictorian, that we need to get rid of salutatorian, is absurd. We need to encourage competition done in the right way, done in a fair way, and reward those that succeed.
Exactly. You know, I look at the stories about where we have some conservatives going around college asking students, what would you say if I took your GPA, and they would ask someone that has a 4.0, and said, what if I took half your GPA and gave it to the person that has 1.6? How would you feel about that? And they would answer, well, I would lose my scholarship to be here because I don't have a high enough GPA for this set scholarship. And they said, well, then I can't get this job because I have to have, you know, a certain GPA score to go into this program. It gets really insane when we do not award people what they deserve. Now, in some cases like me, I'm kind of like the underdog guy. I end up being between the 2.5 to 3.5 range, but I end up finding that one or two or three special things I'm good at, and I have a 4.0. And that's the thing. You should award people at different ranges of what they should be. You know, I believe a valedictorian should get their award. I believe this is the way it should be done, because if you don't, then you're changing what's important. And if you change what's important and everybody gets awarded, then people aren't going to want to work as hard anymore. You know, what's the point unless you're going to turn around and tell me, well, we're just going to allow everyone to have a 4.0 today and you're not going to have to do anything. Is that what we're trying to do? We have this argument that we need to have better education, but we're not trying to make what it takes to get there any better. And what does it mean to be the top? We want to argue, well, the 1% of the world has got all the money. I'm like, do you know who put the 1% of the world there? You did. The college educators did. You're the ones who graded their homework and gave them the A.
And why are we having this war? It's really a class warfare. Why are we demonizing people for making money and passing it to their children? You know, I remember a conversation that I had with an Occupy Wall Street protester.
Mm-hmm.
Was upset because he was fired from Walmart for breaking company policy and the fact that he was only paid $10 an hour.
Uh-huh.
He's like, why should I only get $10 an hour when the owners of Walmart, who have nothing to do with the company and are rich just because they're Sam Walton's kids, why should they have all their money? It's this attitude of entitlement that we should, you know, everybody should get the same. I deserve, I deserve, I deserve. Well, let me tell you this. You don't deserve anything. You earn it. And I, you know, it's a sad state of our country when people are going around saying, I deserve an education. I deserve to make this much money. It's absolutely not true. You know, you should be paid based on the work you do. And if you earn enough money that you want to give it to your kids, why should the government care? You know, I'm reminded of a story that a college professor once told and an experiment that he did with his class. His class were all, you know, he, at the beginning of the semester, he asked his class, how many of you are socially liberal, Democrats? And the majority of the class raised his hand. He started asking why. It was the same reason. You know, I want this. I want that. I should get this. You know, the haves and the have-nots. So he said, here's what we're going to do. For this semester, your grades are going to be based off all of your work. It'll be a cumulative grade. So, however, basically the average is what everybody will get. You know, so if the average is a C, you all get a C. The average is an A, you all get an A. So essentially taking, you know, rewarding those that do nothing and helping and hurting those that do work. Well, the first test comes and goes, and everybody was pretty, you know, so those that did nothing were upset those that did nothing were happy because they didn't study for the test, they didn't prepare for it all, and at the end of the day, they got a B, which was higher than they've ever got. Now, those that studied and prepared and would have got A's, they got a B as well because that was a class average.
Mm-hmm.
So the next test comes along, and those that did, you know, those that had before done all the work now said, what's the point? Why am I going to do it? You know, I'm not going to be rewarded for my work. And those before that hadn't done any work continued to say, fine, I'm not going to do anything, you know, I'll rely on the others and get their grades. Well, the average was, at that point, a D on the second test, and they complained to the professor. And he said, hey, the deal was, you know, you guys are going to get your work, you know, your grade based off what you do as a class. And you know, the mantra of this story, I mean, is that is the government we're creating, and it is socialism. And it's not necessarily blamed on Obama or even to an extent George Bush. Mm-hmm. It's a reflection of society and that we no longer want to work for what we have. You know, we can blame our leaders for enacting policies, but we have to remember that the leaders that we know what they're going to do. Barack Obama told us what he was going to do when he was elected.
Yes,
he didn't hide anything in terms of what he wanted to accomplish. So, you know, it comes back to that. And I know our time is running short and there is an issue that I want to talk about that is very important and I think will have some interesting consequences. And again, it does tie into Obama, and that's the Trayvon Martin shooting.
Yes.
So we're obviously getting more and more information out now from what before was this public outcry that we needed to get rid of, that George Zimmerman needed to be prosecuted, you know, with racism, blah, blah, blah. And I'll admit, I was one of the ones that at first said, hey, you know, this looks suspicious. This looks something wrong with this. But now we're seeing more and more evidence come out that he was bloody, that witnesses are saying he had his head pounded into the pavement repeatedly. You know, and that's what at the end of the day, this does look like a case of self-defense. And I do want to give a little disclaimer here that, you know, yes, I used to be a special deputy county attorney. I was in that position as an intern. But my opinion of this is my own. It in no way reflects any prosecutor's opinion. You know, the prosecutors in Florida believe that they have the evidence to go forward with a prosecution.
Mm-hmm.
But my personal opinion is this is self-defense. And I made a comment a moment ago about how this ties into Obama.
Mm-hmm.
But first I want to go back. In 2000, I believe it was in 2009, 2010, we had what became known as the Beer Summit, when a Harvard officer, you know, saw a guy what looked to appear breaking into his house, and it turns out it was a Harvard professor who was black, the cop was white, and it turned into this big controversy on whether the cop was racist. Obama decided to put himself in the middle of that situation, and when he really shouldn't have, it wasn't a national issue, it wasn't anything a president should even be involved in. And we see again the same thing here. Within, you know, a month or so after the Martin shooting, when it really started to gain ground and gain attention, then President Obama made a comment, you know, that's my son. He could be my son.
Yeah.
You know, what was the point of that, besides to flare up additional racial tension? And then we have the media and how they've played into it. Because the media, especially NBC, they ended a very important piece of evidence when they played it over the airwaves. They edited the phone call, the 911 tape, to make it sound like George Zimmerman was volunteering that the guy who was chasing Trayvon Martin was black and that's why he was following him, which is absolutely not the truth. If you've listened to the full unedited version of the tape, you will hear the dispatcher ask George Zimmerman, is he white, black, Hispanic? And George Zimmerman says, I think he is black. It was in response to a question. Zimmerman did not volunteer this. Now, I'm not saying Zimmerman's completely in the right, because Zimmerman was told by the dispatcher to back off and let police handle it, you know, not to follow the guy. And he chose to follow him. How much that'll play into it, I don't know. But what I do know is that Zimmerman, at the time of the shooting, was being punched and, you know, was being punched, had his head being smashed into the ground by Trayvon Martin. Now, it has also came out that Trayvon Martin, had THC in his system. We all know THC is marijuana.
Mm-hmm.
This, I think, goes against what has been portrayed in the media, that Trayvon Martin was this innocent little kid, you know, that was going to the store to buy tea and Skittles and never done anything wrong in his life. We're seeing more and more that that was not necessarily the case. I guess the point of all of this is you really have to be careful, especially at the presidential level, of sticking your head, A, where it doesn't belong, and B, thinking before you speak.
You're exactly right. I mean, me having the military background on this, you know, having a top secret clearance, you having the law background, the one thing that you and I have in common is that phrase of beyond a shadow of a doubt, you know, knowing all the facts, you know, discovery is what they're going through right now for the case, which for those of you who are interested in wanting to know, discovery is the point in a case where information amongst both sides is being shared freely, you know, so that nobody, you know, gets caught off guard. Yeah, you might have surprise witness, but that's not included in that. That's separate. For those of you interested, I have actually represented myself in court and won, and the judge was so impressed that I was able to give the court ruling on the case. So I understand this wholeheartedly, fully, from that one moment. But anywho, the whole thing with the media and the whole thing with American people, this only proves how much radio, TV, cable, internet completely grasps the average American's mind so much that they don't question anything that happened. I'll give you a good historic fact. Orson Welles was on the radio one day, and he started talking about aliens landing on the earth and causing chaos and discord. And what happened? The American people freaked out and started thinking it was the end of the world, and people were hiding in their basements, and people were getting weapons, and all sorts of crazy stuff all over the United States. Well, this Trayvon Martin case is like the Orson Welles War of the War. You know, that whole crazy analogy of, we normally want to trust our media. Yes, I understand it. There are journalists that have great degrees and a lot of accolades, and they report good stories. A lot of times you hear a bunch of negative stories, and we're supposed to trust them. But when it comes to any case, and I understand this one, it was very tough to even know this happened. What happened is that NBC, two people have been fired from NBC over this already. Because my job in the Coast Guard, being a, you know, operations specialist, was overseeing the voice digital logger. So when someone would call in a Mayday case, or I would talk on the radio for anything, air traffic control to ground control, boat control, submarine, whatever, whomever I'm talking to, all this information was saved and had to be played back if brought to a court of law. Well, that's what happened. You don't, as a journalist for ratings, edit something out like that. I think that goes completely against all, you know, journalistic codes of morality, that you're wanting to bring a black and white truth, regardless of how you feel on the instance. That's how old journalism is. Now, we have journalists and we have media companies that are all completely one-sided on different issues, and you don't hear a whole truth anymore. I mean, we have to go to the internet now and other media outlets to find the whole story. I mean, just recently, YouTube deleted Carl Gallup's YouTube page for absolutely no reason. They just reinstated it, and a couple of others. A bunch of things are happening, and I would not doubt between now and November, there will be more racial instances like Trayvon Martin, more other cases where not all of the facts are being given to you. And I really ask you to kind of do what Glenn Beck says. I challenge you to go with boldness. Challenge what you find out and become educated yourself. If this is a case, go look more into the case. Ask the questions. Because if we don't question those that are in authority in some cases like these, then you'll be fooled time and time again. Especially, what if this is your family? What if you were George Zimmerman's family and you knew the facts from his point of view, or even if you're Trayvon Martin's family? Everybody wanted the facts, you know?
And that's, I mean, that's going to ultimately be, you know, I don't know how much time we have left, but if this is about it, you know, the quote that I'm reminded of and I think is fitting at the end of the day is what Ronald Reagan said. Trust, but verify.
Exactly. Trust, but verify. Ronald Reagan. That's a good quote to end this evening. I'd like to thank you, Josh, for coming today, man. It's been a great time.
Thanks for having me on. It's been a pleasure.
All right. Well, we'll see you again some other time soon in the future.
Absolutely.
All right. Talk to you later. That was Josh Turner, president of the PSL Federalist Society, candidate of the 2013 Phoenix School of Law. He's a great man, working this summer with the Harvard Online. I just want to thank you guys for tuning in for this special this evening. This will be uploaded later, and we will have a show tonight at 7 p.m. Eastern. God bless, and we'll see you soon.